Council in 2020, so that included the approval of the specific plan along with the development agreement. The specific plan was part of a week-long citywide charrette process where the concept was developed with a lot of input. That concept was then brought back to the Planning Commission and City Council for endorsement, and then that became the basis for preparation of the specific plan. So one of the features of the specific plan was this linear park. So this is, there's an existing creek, Turtle Creek, that had been basically degraded by, you know, 100 years of agricultural uses. So the idea was to reestablish that creek and create a linear park that would then connect to Royal Oak Park, which is an existing city park right here. So these are the, you know, straight out of the specific plan. So this is the overall plan. And then this green area here is what we originally was called Turtle Creek Park, it's now called Creekside Park. The idea was it was going to be a public community park, but it was going to be a linear park. So it was more of a linear feature around an existing rehabilitated creek. City worked together, so the Community Services Department, your Parks Department, during the specific plan development process identified different facilities that were needed. Some of those facilities were assigned to the Beechwood specific plan, some were assigned to this project, so the pickleball court, the restrooms, and then the rehabilitation of Royal Oak Park with the new basketball court and the new playground. That was all part of the process. So that's how we got to the design of the park. What we're expecting today is the is the pickleball court and the trails and the bathroom that's here in this phase one area. So that was all negotiated as part of the specific plan. In addition, the specific plan and the development agreement also outlined all the maintenance responsibility for all the facilities. So because this is a city park, the city is responsible for maintaining the active recreational facilities. These hatched areas are all the habitat restoration areas, and those are actually requirements of the developer. Those are requirements of the U.S. government that those have to be restored. So they're responsible for 5 to 7 years, depending on the plant type, to maintain that. Once they're done, it is city property, then City Public Works will basically take over the long-term maintenance. But because it's a natural creek, it should just be limited to weed abatement in the summer. In addition, these blue areas are detention basins that were part of the project. They ended up being located next to the creek because that's where all the water needs to go. So that has a more complex maintenance share, which is illustrated with these little diagrams here. But the landscaping, the slopes, the fencing, those all are the responsibility of the project, which is the HOA long term. The actual drainage facilities, the inlets, the outlets, the concrete structures that are storm control features, those will be maintained by Public Works. So that's the purpose of the maintenance agreement, is to clarify exactly how all of these features will be maintained in the future.
With regard to item 5, and I'm not sure if you want to have Ryan come up. Ryan, would you kind of explain this item to the public? I think it's kind of impressive of what we've done over the years with this, and I
would like to know what they've accomplished, basically. And you rarely see
a tax rate of 0000, right? So you can explain that as well.
Yes, good evening, City Mr. Mayor and City Council. Ryan Cornell, Services Director.
The item before you is the approval of the general obligation tax rate. Back in 1998, the voters approved Measure D98, which was a bond measure or bond authorization that funded a number of capital projects throughout the city, including the Niblick Bridge, the 13th Street Bridge, the Public Safety Center, Barney Sports Park, the Senior and Veteran Center, and the like. There was a whole laundry list of different projects that this revenue bond funded. So since 1998, or right around 1999, when we actually took the bonds out, we've been slowly paying back that debt service. So the debt service expires in fiscal year 27-28. Because the assessed values have increased so rapidly, we've been slowly reducing the rate below our maximum allowable. Now we're at the finish line, so we actually have enough fund reserves plus some lingering revenues that are going to be coming in this next year to cover the rest of the debt service payment. So we don't need to collect any more taxes from the residents for this particular bond.
So the question I was going to ask on that, I'm not sure if it's legal, if it's, I don't know what the bond structure looks like, and if it makes sense for zero. If we don't, and if we have any bond needs coming up, I don't think we do, why not pay it off and just zero it out?
Yes, depending on the specific bond, they come callable at different,
sure,
at different time, or different years, different fiscal years. We're such to the end, it's going to be so minute to, you know, the interest rates that we've been saving, setting money now versus later. At the end of the day, we still need to figure out how to close out this fund completely as well.
So I don't, there is no benefit really to doing that. I looked at the numbers. There's not a whole lot of numbers that you provided to us, but you don't see a benefit to paying it off.
Not 2 years early. No.
Yeah, okay. Thought I'd ask. Thanks. I have another question on six.
Hang on. Fred, did you have a question too?
No.
Okay. You have your light on. Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Thanks. On the water stations that we're anticipating, Leslie, on the water stations, is there any kind of maintenance on those? Is that strictly a water fountain? Is there any filtration that has to be maintained? And if so, is there any cost to that?
So there will be, am I on? Can you guys hear me?
Okay.
So the application is for 19 water bottle filling stations. As Chris mentioned, there isn't a match for city funds to install it. There will be a maintenance cost associated with that. So it will be, you know, it will be a public facility, and the city will be maintaining that.
Just put some water to my house.
Is that something we should be budgeting for? Negligible? Do we have a guesstimate on what those are going to be on an annual basis?
I can, you know, look into that and provide more information if you'd
like.
Is that
something we are just going, I mean, we know we're going to be able to budget for?
I believe we'll be able to absorb the cost typically, or I believe, and Ms. Frazier can correct me, a lot of what we're trying to do here is replace existing water fountains, so that are under the useful life or they're non-operational. And so we need to do that, I think, one way or another in a lot of the facilities. So as we transition to like newer technology, like the filtered bottle stations, I don't want to use the term, it's the cost of doing business, but we will factor that into future year maintenance budgets. And we're actually going through a top to bottom approach from an asset management perspective on what we have in terms of these types of assets. So I'm assuming that'll also be built into that program and into future year projections. But we will factor that in future budget years if we get the grant.
And the other way I thought about it is we're doing a parks upgrade anyway. And so I don't know if it would come out of that budget. It's necessary, and it is something, kind of a cost of doing business. And I think it's a benefit, it's an enhancement, but I just want to make sure we're aware of it. Thank you.
Okay, I think we're finished with all the council questions. And we've had public comment.
One quick comment.
Sure, Brett, go ahead.
And that is, in my observation this week, was that right after the break of dawn, right after the break of day, the pickleball carts start being used.
Yeah.
And before it gets hot, they're all in full use.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real good investment for the public.
Absolutely.
With that, I'm willing to move approval of consent calendar items 1 through 9.
Second.
Okay, a motion by Strong, second by Gregory. Any discussion on the items? Okay, we'll call for the question.
Councilmember Strong?
Aye.
Councilmember Gregory?
Aye.
Councilmember Bausch?
Aye.
Councilmember Beal?
Aye.
Mayor Hammond?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously.
I will say also, I believe we're scheduled for September 10th for the actual ribbon cutting on pickleball. I think that's what staff has been working on right now. Is that about what we see, Chris?
Yeah, we're going to get our courts confused and mixed up here, but yes, the Sherwood courts, yes.
Sherwood, right.
September 10th, 10 a.m. is when we've scheduled that ribbon cutting. So that'll be an exciting opportunity. And then we will schedule a formal ribbon cutting for the new, these other courts that you accepted this evening.
Yeah.
At a later time to be determined, but we'll make that announcement when that date and time's available.
Very good. Thank you. All right, moving on then, we'll go ahead and get to public hearings. We'll open public hearing for the first item, introduction, first reading and of an ordinance amending municipal code title 14.02. for AB 1572 compliance. Kirk, you have our item for us?
Am I on? Mic test. You guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mayor Hammond. Members of the council, please be here this evening presenting item K1 for us. This is the introduction and first reading by title only of an ordinance to amend the city's municipal code for compliance with State Assembly Bill 1572. Slide, please. Thank you. Assembly Bill 1572 establishes a phased statewide prohibition on irrigation of non-functional turf with potable water. It applies to public properties. I'm sorry? You guys can't hear me. I put it in my mouth. Thank you. No, no problem. Let me do this. Give me just a moment. No worries. Okay. Is that, that's better? Not too loud. Okay. So I'll start over. The Assembly Bill 1572 has been established by the state, and it effectively prohibits irrigation of non-functional turf on a handful of properties using potable water. Those properties that it does apply to are listed here on the left-hand side of the slide. Public and government properties are affected. Commercial, industrial, and other institutional properties, also HOAs and common interest properties are affected. The prohibition does not apply to independently owned residential properties. It doesn't apply to recreational or community gathering areas. Obviously, those are exempted. They're considered functional turf areas. It also doesn't apply to cemeteries or areas where irrigation with potable water is required to maintain tree health. Slide, please. Whose slide? Yeah, I couldn't get it to work. Oh, there we go. It's working now. Sorry about the technical difficulties there. So there's a couple requirements that the city must fulfill to comply with AB 1572. The first is that as a public water supplier, we need to adopt changes to our water use policies to conform to the state's requirements, and we also need to communicate those requirements to our customers. So that's really the item that's before you this evening. Additionally, as a property owner, we also need to comply with the prohibitions on the city-controlled or city-owned properties. And the timelines for the phased implementation for that prohibition are described here on the second portion of the slide. So public and local government properties need to comply by January 1st of 2027. The following year, commercial, industrial, and other institutional properties are required to comply. And then by January 1st of 2029, HOAs and common interest properties need to comply. I do want to kind of emphasize here that, again, we're just dealing with the changes to the municipal code this evening. We've already started the communication, the outreach steps for making our public aware of those changes. So we're just focusing on that portion. But I will speak a little bit later to some of the requirements that we'll need to fulfill as property owners and maintainers of these areas. All right, so next, just to briefly discuss kind of examples and the definition overall of non-functional turf. I think in general, non-functional turf is a turf area, which is a grass mowed area, as the state defines it. And non-functional means that it doesn't have a use for public gathering or recreation. So when we're talking about functional turf areas, recreation fields, playgrounds, those sorts of facilities, community gathering areas, those are all exempt, or you know, this prohibition does not apply to them. But in terms of non-functional turf, you know, parking strips, medians, parkways, those sorts of things will be impacted by this. This is what the legislation really focuses on. This next slide kind of summarizes our implementation. On the left-hand side is kind of where we are now. Before January of 2027, the city needs to, again, notify our public and revise or make changes to our municipal code to mirror the requirements of the state. And then on the right-hand side of the slide are those kind of step-through phased implementation. First, public agencies, government properties in 2027, commercial, industrial, and other institutional in 2028, and then HOAs and what have you in 2029. Real briefly here, I want to just highlight some of the outreach that we've done so far. Our staff's been working to make and maintain a website. We posted that quite a few months back. It's really dedicated to resources for the community and folks that are subject to these changes that they could use to really understand what the changes are and figure out how to best comply with them. We've also been conducting direct outreach through mailers in our, you know, bill inserts and emails. We've also hosted one workshop so far in partnership with a couple of other agencies, and that was to get the word out there to the community, and we do plan to have follow-up workshops in the coming years as well. And then finally, I do want to mention our long-standing turf rebate program is still in effect, so folks that want to convert an eligible, you know, grass area and get it onto a drought-tolerant landscape, that's still available if they haven't participated yet. Okay, so now stepping away from the item this evening in terms of what the city will have to do beyond what we're doing, recommending tonight, we will need to, again, comply at the city-owned properties, and that does include city rights of way. So our city departments that have responsibility for those areas, they're you know, well aware of these requirements, and they're in the process of evaluating and assessing the areas that are subject to and will be affected by the prohibition. And they're also developing the best strategies, and those are unique to the different use sites and areas. So they'll be coming to council with, I think, an overall, you know, an overview of what the issues are and how they'd recommend best addressing them and prioritizing. And there's a handful of options here I summarize on the slide. First of all, we need to stop irrigating with potable water on these non-functional turf areas and look to, you know, moving to a drought-tolerant landscape alternative. There's other areas at city facilities that may, you know, they may appear to be non-functional turf, but we have other intentions or designs for those. And so the city is talking about more formally documenting those uses such that when it comes to compliance down the road, we'll be able to point to those. Real briefly, in terms of enforcement, the state of California has primary enforcement authority. They've outlined a framework that really focuses on a self-certification process where basically property owners that have more than 5,000 square feet of irrigated landscape will self-certify that they're in compliance with these requirements, and that's scheduled to begin in 2030, so quite some time away. And there are penalties for folks that aren't complying with the regulation. Also, cities, I understand, can be subjected to the fines if they don't make the changes that are before you this evening. We do, as a local water system and city, have an option to enforce if we choose. However, at this time, staff is recommending that we continue to focus on outreach and education for the public. In terms of fiscal impacts, adoption of the ordinance will have no immediate impact on us, apart from our staff time and our, you know, the costs for the outreach that we've been doing. But we do anticipate that there will be some impacts on our water fund revenue. As we step through this phased implementation, we'll see reduced water use and revenue impact there. And then additionally and separately, there'll be costs associated with converting non-functional turf areas on city property and within city rights of way to, you know, a drought-tolerant landscape. We don't have a good handle on what all those are at this point, but we'll be coming to you guys with more information on that. And I think we talked about enforcement already, so we'll skip that. Oh, you know what? We're going backwards. apologize. Okay, so this second to last slide here, just again summarizing where we are in the process and a couple of key dates. This is the first reading and introduction this evening. We're scheduled for the second reading and adoption on September 1st. And then we'll come, you know, complying with the prohibitions, and self-certification is still quite a ways off. So this slide here, the final slide, I have a URL to the website that I mentioned earlier that can help customers in terms of compliance and understanding the regulations themselves, and a QR code and the recommendation for this evening. That concludes the report, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Kirk.
Sure.
Questions, staff?
I have one.
Pro Tem Gregory.
Yeah, Kirk, just a couple quick questions. So it looks like it's in there already, but you know, I want to make sure that a lot of our turf in these islands or roadways have trees, so they're going to allow us to continue to maintain the trees, so that's going to be okay to do, continue. And does that apply also to the private sector?
Yes. My understanding is that where ceasing irrigation with potable water would affect tree health, you're exempt. But I do think that, you know, in the near term, that's a reasonable reason to continue to irrigate what would otherwise be a non-functional turf area. I do think that the state will look to agencies for further compliance. So while in the immediate term, it may not be really something feasible where if we turn off that irrigation immediately, those shallow roots are going to suffer because they've long received that you know, shallow water source. I think this, you know, if you look at the timeline, the state seems to be fairly lenient in terms of timing as well as the enforcement approach. But I do think that there's going to be maybe more enforcement down the way and more scrutiny on those areas.
Right. Thank you.
Sure.
Councilman Strong.
Yes, I'm concerned for the public. Our rents are high enough. And if we have so many homeowners associations, and it's effective for them as of the first of next year, 2027.
Actually, they're the last to be required to make those changes. Then it'll be 29. So January 1st of 2029.
2029?
That's correct.
Okay, well, that's a little bit different. And then the state is enforcing at $1,000 a day penalty.
That's what they're allowed to enforce.
They're allowed to, no, they could charge less than that.
They may. We're not enforcing. I don't have all the details, and to be honest, the framework is pretty light at this point.
All right.
For enforcement.
Very, very good. I just think our homeowners association should be well aware of what their responsibilities are going to be, so they can deal with it well in advance. And if we can keep them informed as to where we're putting purple pipe, so that maybe they can hook into it for their irrigation systems and then put it on their water meters, I think that would be useful and mutually beneficial. Thank you.
I agree.
Councilmember Balish.
Thank you. Kirk, I'm not sure this is a viable solution anywhere, or especially here in Paso Robles, but some of the things I'm reading about would be using reclaimed water, non-potable water, while we're waiting for purple pipe, and using that, putting that into a water truck and bringing it around and irrigating things like trees to keep those alive while the solution's worked out. I don't know, I just kind of put that into the spitballs that are going out there and thinking about possible solutions. I don't know if we have a spare water truck floating around in the city yard someplace or not, but and maybe that is something that we can consider. If that's a legal use, we had a complaint along Charlet, the trees were drying up and already, and this is before you know any of this takes effect. I would hate to see the trees that have been, you know, we're used to seeing trees that in the school parking lots, for example, schools that are in, or trees that are in school yards. What are we going to do with those? So we need to come up with a good cooperative solution. So hopefully we can come up with that. Thanks.
Chris, you have any questions?
No.
Kirk, I do. Can you give the public and us basically an overview of our portfolio of water? I mean, this is designed clearly to save water on the state's part. thinking that we need to save every potable drop. Although, can you give us an overview of what our city's water resources are?
Sure. Yes, so yeah, happy to do so. So the city does have a fairly robust and reliable water supply portfolio, so we're fortunate in that way. And that is different than, you know, a lot of communities in California. We're still required to comply with this, despite having sufficient water, but we do have, you know, multiple sources. We've got underflow from the Salinas River. We've got the Nacimiento water, which we heard about a bit earlier. We've got the groundwater source as well. And as you guys know, we've got the recycled water program that we've been working through developing segments.
Roughly 13,000 acre feet, roughly, is what I remember. And then of that, build out will only use about 9,500, roughly. So there's quite a lot of extra water that the city has that we will never really need to, for at least for our current plan. And so that's what I'm trying to get at. When I know the public got to understand that this is something that they're thinking we're running out of water, or the reason we're doing this from the state level is that we're running out of water. It's not really true. It's just this is something on the Sacramento side that they want to see all cities reduce, and this is going across all of California, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, okay. All right, good. It's one more thing from Sacramento. Anything else from here? We'll open up then to the public. Anybody wishing to have a comment on this, please come forward. Dale?
At one point, the developer was proposing a swimming pool, and I never understood if that was finalized as part of the development. If it was, we want to make sure that there's an entity that's going to be liable for the use of that pool for any damages.
Okay. Anyone else? Bob? Yeah. Welcome.
Bob Simone, Christina Court, Paso Robles. I live in one of those neighborhoods that has parking strips with grass and trees separating the sidewalk from
called
the streets.
Parkways. They're called parkways.
Yeah, they're called parkways. Right. Are there any thoughts that you would reconfigure the sprinklers so that just the trees are getting water and not the grass? Or are you going to continue watering both until you come up with some other solution?
Anyone else? Okay, Kirk, yeah, if you can go ahead and answer that question, please.
Yes, that's a great observation there, and that is, I think, one of the strategies that the city will be looking at, is what modifications can be made to irrigation systems and other, you know, retrofits for the landscaping. So that, I think, will be an important part of finding a solution.
Are you going to try to get that done by January 1, or possibly?
You know, I can't speak to that definitively, but I know that our staff have been looking at options for that. It will take time to get that work done. There's a lot of affected areas, and you know, taking those planning steps, then budgeting for those changes is going to take some time. I think, in a lot of ways, we're fortunate in that, you know, in January, grass doesn't need as much water, vegetation doesn't in general. And so that could afford us a little bit more time to get that critical work done. But again, there is that exemption where tree health is an important exception for this legislation. And so that, I think, we can leverage to buy ourselves more time in some ways.
It's clear this is going to be an expense on the city's part to get things changed over. And it's going to be in the budget. I'm not sure. Did we plan for this in our current budget? I don't think so.
So, Mayor and City Council, so we plan to come back to you in October with a more exhaustive review of what the city, what staff will be recommending to you to undertake as part of this process and compliance. We're doing those site evaluations as we speak, trying to determine what meets the absolute and clear definition of non-functional turf. There are other areas of the city that you know, we talked about tonight, like trees that have turf nearby, or turf next to a city facility that is used periodically for gatherings or other types of utilization, where we'll look to reclassify that as functional turf. So that's the process we're going through right now. you know, in terms of the changes that will have to be made, that's also part of the evaluation and what we estimate the cost will be. Some of these will be in the landscape and lighting districts, so just to keep that in mind, and those are separate assessments that are assessed to property owners in the area for the benefit of the nearby landscaping. And so some of this will be borne by the individual landscape and lighting district areas. Part of it will be, you know, the general fund, and then I would imagine that there are other facilities that are in enterprise funds that will you know, bear some cost as well. But we're still tallying up precisely what we're going to have to do to be in the spirit of compliance as of January 1st.
Right. I think, again, what you're speaking to is mostly the east side developments are in those landscape and lighting districts, but mostly the west side, the old part of town, Vine Street, Spring Tree, although that's going to be the big nut to crack, I think. So, comment, anyway?
I just want to wish Dwayne and his team the best wishes for going around and mapping and identifying and inventorying all of these areas that we need to address. And great job on the presentation.
Okay, Councilman Boucher.
So not only you mentioned in your slide, but I don't want to make light of it, the expense as we do the conversion process, but the loss of revenue as we go forward, is it going to be significant? Is it I think a lot of the irrigation is probably being billed off of an irrigation meter rather than a residential, so you don't have that sewer component on the water bill, but it's still going to be a significant amount of revenue loss as that's turned no longer billed. We saw a loss of revenue during the drought, and it took a while to recover from that, so we can look ahead and plan for that now. That would be very, very important. The other thing that we're reading about is people's are anticipating water rates will have to rise. And if that's the case, we should start warning people now. I hope that's not the case here in Paso Robles, but if it is, we should start having that discussion sooner than later.
Yeah, the loss of water revenue does still impact our bottom line, and we still have to have the facility to provide water at a certain level of cost, no matter what. So that's going to be a problem.
That's correct. Okay. I would say, and that's a really good point, with this phased implementation, we're going to see these changes over time. So we're fortunate in that regard, and we'll be able to adjust along the way. But you're correct. We will see a revenue reduction with those water savings.
Okay. Melissa, do we have a caller?
No, sir.
Okay. Very good. Okay, thank you, Kirk. We'll bring it back then here. Let's,
for discussion?
Ahead. Discussion and or action.
Yeah, for discussion on this item, you know, let's not be too hasty in taking out turf, because if you read the archaeological reports on what's going on, that's going to affect our El Nino and what's going on in the oceans right now and underneath the ocean, we may be in for some of the, not just rain, but flooding, and that turf is going to absorb a lot of that water that may prevent some of the flooding that could happen in this city. So we might not want to get rid of that turf too quickly, because depending upon how long this El Nino factor lasts, and it could be decades, not just a year or two, and we better be careful, because there are major changes coming geologically to this earth right now, and don't ignore them. Become acquainted with them. They're very important to our future, so be careful.
Pro Tem Baker.
Yep. I'd like to go ahead and make a motion. And my first comment is just another taking by the state of California of our rights. We don't need it to happen. But I move to introduce by first reading the title only ordinance XXXXNS, amending Title 14 of the City of Paso del Robles Municipal Code for California Assembly Bill 1572 compliance.
Second.
Motion by Gregory, second by Beal. Discussion? Okay, we'll call for the question, Melissa.
Councilmember Gregory?
Aye.
Councilmember Beal?
Aye.
Councilmember Bausch?
Aye.
Councilmember Strong?
Aye.
Mayor Hammond?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously.
Okay. we'll close that public hearing. Then we'll open up item two on public hearing, introduction, first reading, title only, ordinance to allow cannabis non-storefront retail and to establish a cannabis regulatory permit, revocation of resolution 22-144, limiting the number of cannabis businesses allowed to operate from premises. Katie Bannister.
Thank you, Mayor Hammond. Yes, as you mentioned, this is an item about cannabis. Obviously, this is an item that's long time in coming. This first slide gives us an idea of just how long it has been. Want to point out that in 2017, the state of California did legalize the delivery of adult use cannabis. So we do not have to allow cannabis delivery offices within the city limits, but we do have to allow the delivery of that product. And so fast forward to 2022, the council did adopt resolution 22-144, which temporarily allowed the three existing cannabis conditional use permit holders to temporarily deliver adult use cannabis. That did expire, but that resolution does still stand. And so that resolution names three businesses that are the only businesses that would be eligible to deliver adult use cannabis should you decide to approve it this evening. Fast forward to this year, back in February, we did take some amendments to the Planning Commission for their consideration. Those were zoning amendments, and that would be to allow the adult use cannabis delivery offices. After the Planning Commission made their recommendation, staff realized that we really did have some additional questions for council that we wanted you to clarify for us before we brought the full amendments. So we did that in May 19th. Council did give us direction. We returned to the Planning Commission on July 14th with additional amendments that reflected the City Council's guidance. The Planning Commission has recommended that the Council allow adult use non-storefront retail businesses and that we would require a cannabis regulatory permit as well. So a lot of the verbiage around cannabis has gotten overly complicated, but the definitions, the first two definitions do come from state law, and so they are included in our ordinances to bring us into conformance with state law. So adult use cannabis is also known as commercial cannabis or recreational cannabis. This is the cannabis that you don't need a doctor's prescription to purchase and use. So adult use cannabis is the same as recreational cannabis. And a non-storefront retail or non-storefront retailer is a fancy way of saying delivery office or delivery business. This is differentiated from a storefront retail, which would be a dispensary. So that a dispensary is not what we're talking about. We're talking about delivery offices where customers do not come to the office. Deliveries are made at a third place where they are requested. And then finally, a business license tax certificate. We have had some confusion of whether or not the business licenses are regulatory. They are not. They are a business license. It's the way that the city collects business licenses. And so they don't dictate where and how a business can operate. They are just how a business pays their taxes. So the amendments that are before you this evening and the existing cannabis framework have conditionally allowed cannabis business activities in the Riverside Corridor, which is the purple area to the west of the Salinas River, and in the C3 zoning districts. The C3 is largely around Highway 46 East and Golden Hill, so that's the pink area out to the east of town. We do have two existing conditional use permits that allow the delivery offices of medical cannabis. They are the yellow and blue stars, and so those are both on Black Oak Drive. So in the proposed ordinance in front of you this evening, there are amendments to the zoning standards. Would require a conditional approval of a conditional use permit by the Planning Commission for a business to have a delivery office that could deliver both or one of medicinal and adult use cannabis. So they would still need to get approval from the Planning Commission. The ordinance would continue to prohibit other commercial cannabis activities, storefront retail, as we mentioned, cultivation, testing, testing, distribution, et cetera. The proposed amendments would eliminate the proposed numerical cap on the number of non-storefront retailers. These are offices. These are businesses that can operate throughout California. We do not anticipate a flood of new applications, and they do create an artificial market for those permits. So staff and the Planning Commission are recommending that we eliminate and do not include a cap on the number of non-storefront retailers. The zoning amendments also would limit the amount of on-site signage that can be applied to a business that is a delivery office. These are not offices where customers should be coming, and there's really no need for significant signage. Finally, the zoning amendments extend the 600-foot separation requirement that is already required of child-serving businesses or entities, facilities. So schools and daycares, cannabis businesses already have to stay at least 600 feet away from those, but the zoning amendments would require a 600-foot separation from public parks as well. You can see that would include the immediate downtown, around Downtown Park, and then out of Barney Schwartz, there's some C3 zoning that's right across the street, and those sites would not be eligible for cannabis businesses because of how close they are to the park. So what we're bringing to you this evening is a full cannabis regulatory permit, a regulatory framework that includes more than just what we have done in the past. So in the past, medicinal cannabis delivery offices have been required to get a conditional use permit, but going forward, staff and the Planning Commission are recommending that a business also be required to acquire a cannabis regulatory permit. We'll dig into what exactly that is. And finally, they also need a business license, and that is the case today, but it would continue. So three reapprovals from the city in order to operate a cannabis business in Paso Robles. So jumping into the conditional use permit, as I mentioned, this has been a requirement for cannabis businesses in the past, but we should understand exactly what a conditional use permit is. So a conditional use permit is a land use entitlement. It does run with the land. It's not specific to any specific any operator, and so that has been a gap in our oversight. It is a one-time approval unless it's revoked, and revocation is complicated. It requires public hearings, and there are a lot of vested rights that come into play. And so, because of the types of issues that a conditional use permit addresses, in the past we've had a gap in oversight that we are looking to fill with the second permit that would be required, which is a cannabis regulatory permit. In order to require this permit, you do need to adopt a new proposed Chapter 5.55 that is included in the draft ordinance. A cannabis regulatory permit would be specific to an operator, so we would really dig in and understand exactly who it is that's operating a cannabis business in our city. It does allow for ongoing and proactive monitoring. In the past, we really have had more reactive reactive oversight. This would allow for annual renewal of a permit, so we would have at a minimum an annual touch on each cannabis business. I will mention that the Planning Commission did recommend cannabis regulatory permits be be renewed every 2 years. Staff is continuing to recommend that the permits be renewed every year for multiple reasons. The first is because the intent of the regulatory permit is to have more frequent touches, more frequent contact with these businesses. And so every 2 years, in staff's opinion, is too far between those checks. In addition, we have found that when we have permits that run with different time limits, it is confusing to the applicants. For instance, the short-term rental permits are valid for 3 years, whereas each short-term rental permit holder has to renew their business license on an annual basis. Every year, it causes confusion. What permit am I renewing? So staff is recommending both for better oversight, but also for clarity with just when permits are due, that the annual renewal happen, the renewals happen on an annual basis. The cannabis regulatory permit also includes operational standards, and we'll jump in a couple slides to see what types of things are addressed in the regulatory permit. It is simpler to revoke a regulatory permit. It doesn't require public hearing. It just requires violations of those operational standards. We have learned that these regulatory permits are best practice for the other cities and municipalities in San Luis Obispo County, Grover Beach, San San Luis Obispo, Morro Bay, who all allow more cannabis businesses, do require a cannabis regulatory permit that is renewed on an annual basis. The final approval from the city that a cannabis business would need is their business license tax certificate. As a reminder, these are not regulatory. They don't determine where a business can locate. It just allows you to pay your business license taxes and your cannabis business taxes. So the Chapter 5.55, the recommended standards for the cannabis regulatory permit include, a lot of items that need to be included if an applicant would like to receive a cannabis regulatory permit. It would require disclosure of all the parties with a financial interest, background checks on the employees and those folks who are going to be operating cannabis businesses in our community. They would have to let us know the license types that they'll have from the Department of Cannabis Control, and then there'll be some additional security plans, hours of operation, training plans, and so forth. So there'll be a lot of items that will need to be provided to the city to get one of these permits. As I mentioned, staff is recommending annual renewal at that time. The police department, with some additional assistance, would be looking at the security plans, how the business is operating. There would be new background checks. We would make sure that the owners are still the same folks that they were a year ago. We would audit their inventory tracking. There would be a physical inspection of the premises as well by the city on an annual basis. So here, as I mentioned, there are some of the operational requirements. I will mention that most of these are state requirements as well. They are in the state code for cannabis businesses. Some of the differences for the local businesses are that the drivers are going to be required to wear visible company-issued ID. There is sometimes confusion when a police officer pulls over a car whether or not the person is authorized to carry cannabis in the more than just a an amount that you would expect to be for sale. So those IDs would help to make those stops a little bit clearer. We do and the city require customer pre-registration, and the drivers are required to carry the delivery manifest. So that's a refinement on state law as well. So you can see here the types of operational requirements, security requirements, contact information to the city, letting the city know, who's delivering cannabis in our community would be required. We did have a question at Planning Commission regarding if folks are coming from outside the city and they are delivering cannabis into our neighborhoods, what standards that are included in the ordinance would apply to those businesses. And so we worked with BBK and the city attorney's office to identify those in the ordinance. So a business that is not located in Paso Robles would also need to have a business license tax certificate, would need to pay their cannabis business taxes. They have to have state licensing. They are limited to the hours of delivery that the local businesses would be limited to. They would also have to carry the delivery manifest. They can't have signage, and the driver would continue to need to wear the company-issued ID. So that is the end of the slides that really dig into the what the ordinance states. Catherine Piotti, the finance manager, is going to come and explain some of the staff's recommendations for how we administer this program. It is a program that spans multiple departments. The Community Development Department, the Police Department, and the Finance Department all have roles to play. And so Catherine is going to come up and explain those practical parts of how we intend to administer the program.
Great. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you, Katie. Good evening, Mayor Hammond and council members. As Katie mentioned, I am Catherine Piotti, the finance manager for the city. And now that we've gone through the framework of the regulatory permit, as well as the various compliance components of the permit process, I'd like to walk you through the options that city council has to consider regarding the administration of the program, as well as the associated fees that come along with the work involved. So when looking at the depth and the regulatory nature of this permit, there were three available options for staff to evaluate. The first option, being option A, is a hybrid service delivery model where the city retains the core administrative and customer service functions of the permitting process while engaging with a specialized consultant for the technical and compliance related aspects. The second option, option B, is a fully in-house model where all the program functions would be performed by city staff. And then the third option, option C, is a fully outsourced delivery model where the permitting program would be entirely handled by a third-party consultant. And I'll dive into the details on each option here in the next couple of slides, but first I do want to mention that the proposed fees for each of the options that you're going to see this evening were developed by looking at the estimated level of effort required for each of the functions and whether that included city staff time or those third-party consultant costs. Additionally, the fees that we are proposing this evening are targeted to meet 100% cost recovery for the services that we will be providing, as the cannabis business that would be applying for the regulatory permit is the sole beneficiary of those services, as opposed to the public. All right. So diving into option A, this slide shows the service responsibilities for both city staff as well as the consultant in our hybrid delivery model. As I mentioned, this model would allow the city to remain the primary contact for the applicants and the sole administrative portion of the program. That would include options such as the application intake, administration, permit coordination with the applicant, as well as working with the consultant on a various amount of functions as well. This model allows the city to maintain and provide a consistent customer experience to our applicants, and equally important, maintain local oversight over the whole permit process. The specialized consultant would supplement city staff with the technical cannabis expertise, and that would include work such as our site evaluations, our annual and pre-permit compliance audits and inspections, as well as technical review of ongoing regulatory compliance. The city currently does not have staff that are dedicated or trained for this level of expertise, and creating that level of expertise that the consultant will be providing in-house would require either additional or dedicated staffing, initial or ongoing training, as well as keeping up with all the regulatory changes that come along with the cannabis industry. So engaging with that consultant will allow the city to have an up-to-date industry expert at our fingertips throughout this process. Additionally, given the anticipated permit volume, staff is not recommending doing this in-house based on the fact that it wouldn't be an efficient use of city resources to maintain and build that expertise within current city staff. So as you can see at the bottom of this slide, option A proposes fees that include an initial application fee of $5,500, an annual renewal fee of $4,600, and a triennial financial audit fee of $11,000. And I'll go into detail on that triennial financial audit fee in a few slides later. Moving on to option B, the fully in-house service delivery model. As you can see, it's just as the name says. As you can see on the table, all of those functions that we talked about in option A are now solely handled by city staff. Now, the benefit of this approach is that the city would have complete internal control over the entire process, the technical and the administrative side. However, with that comes additional costs. As I mentioned before, the city would need to either dedicate or hire additional staff and provide that initial and ongoing training, as well as maintain that sufficient staffing for the capacity to accommodate fluctuations in application activity. That means the city would continue to incur staffing and training costs even when periods of application activity are relatively low. So similar to option A, the proposed fees for option B include an initial application fee of $7,900, an annual renewal fee of $6,700, and a triennial audit fee of $12,000. So one thing I do want to note on the proposed fees for option B is the proposed fees that are included there include the staff time to perform the functions listed in this table. They do not currently include any additional costs associated with hiring staff or providing that ongoing training. So should council direct staff to proceed with option B, there would need to be some additional analysis done to include those costs, which will significantly increase the proposed cost for option B. All right, and last but not least, option C is our fully outsourced delivery model, which would entail a third-party consultant handling the entire process. And while this model would certainly allow for that subject matter expertise that the consultant could provide, staff ultimately deemed this option not viable due to the fact that there are several functions within this whole permitting process that require direct city involvement. And some of those items include the integration with current permitting processes and approval processes that would have to go in coordination with this permit, interdepartment coordination, public accountability, and ultimately retaining that final permitting authority on the decision making. Also, based on the fact that a third-party consultant cannot provide all the services from start to finish, there was no potential cost information available to be able to calculate proposed fees for this option. In addition to our internal evaluation, we also reviewed what our neighboring jurisdictions are charging for comparable regulatory services relating to cannabis. So on this slide, you are going to see our neighboring jurisdictions who have established fees and programs for cannabis regulatory services, as well as our proposed fees for option A, which is staff's recommendation. It's important to note, while all of these fees on this slide are for cannabis-related businesses, most of the neighboring jurisdictions listed allow storefront retail or dispensaries, so their fees are responsive for that activity, whereas our proposed fees for option A simply are for non-storefront delivery cannabis businesses. So while we might not be comparing apples to apples exactly, you'll see that our proposed fees do reflect the difference in potential business activity. So as you can see on this screen, initial application fees for the other jurisdictions ranged anywhere from $10,000 to $27,000 compared to our proposed initial application fee of $5,500. Additionally, annual renewal fees ranged anywhere from $10,000 to $54,000 compared to our proposed annual renewal fee of $4,600. And here's where I'd like to highlight the proposed financial audit fee. So staff is recommending that the required triennial financial audit fee be listed and charged as a separate fee and charged when the audit actually occurs, rather than building the cost into either our initial application or our annual renewal fee. So some of our neighboring jurisdictions took a different approach and actually incorporate that periodic audit cost into their application, initial application, or their annual renewal fees, which also is part of the reason you'll see a gap between their fees and our proposed fees. Also, I wanted to point out that most of our neighboring jurisdictions do require an annual financial audit, whereas staff is recommending, as of now, a triennial, so an audit every 3 years for our cannabis businesses. And this is partially due to the flexibility that's within the regulatory permit framework that allows us to request access to financial records as needed, and due to the fact that our cannabis business taxes are currently fairly low. So should the council direct staff to perform financial audits on a more frequent basis, the proposed fee would still remain the same. It would just be applicable more often. And there would be updates needed to our regulatory permit language. And then one more reminder on that is that these proposed fees are representative of the costs associated with non-storefront retail delivery businesses only. And should storefront retail businesses be considered at a later date, a new evaluation of the costs involved with that, as well as the proposed fees, would need to be done at that time due to the varying differences between the business types. All right. In addition to our initial application renewal and audit fee, staff is proposing two additional administrative fees, a fee for appeals and revocation, as well as a permit transfer request fee. These are simply administrative fees that would only apply if the associated action occurs. And for the proposed fee, we are recommending that the appeals and revocation fee be based on actual time and materials needed to process the appeal or revocation. And then with the permit transfer request fee, that is essentially going to be treated as a new application. It's going to go through the same processes, and so whichever option council recommends this evening, the fee for that permit transfer request will be proposed to be set at the same as the initial application fee. Additionally, the fees listed down below under existing services and fees are services and fees that are already in place within the city that a cannabis business applying for a regulatory permit would most likely be subject to as well. And those are things such as the conditional use permit that Katie went over, building permits if TIs or tenant improvements are needed on building spaces, as well as the business license tax certificate and cannabis business tax. And so that's just for a transparency purpose for our applicants as well as council to know that